I'll call the next case, Ortiz v. Aurora Healthcare, 10-3465. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Watson. Did I say your name correctly?
Yes,
Watson.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, thank you very much for allowing us to discuss this case with you this morning. This case arises on a certification of direct appeal from the bankruptcy court. It really has to do with Wisconsin state law, which is unique, I think, in how this case got to the court, but also that we would have you sitting as if you were a Wisconsin state Supreme Court. The issue before us is really about medical privacy. That is, the medical information, meaning the care, the disease one would have, and the treatments one would have, that is found within a patient health care record, which is also defined in the Wisconsin statutes. So ultimately, it's about privacy, and it's about medical care privacy. The statutes involved here are Wisconsin Statute 99550, which is the general right of privacy in Wisconsin. It's important to note that privacy was never a common law right in Wisconsin. It is only a statutory right in Wisconsin. And that's important because it shows that the legislature made this a very, very important right. In Wisconsin,
and speaking of that right, the statute authorizes recovery for persons injured as a result of a violation. Here, the plaintiffs haven't shown any actual damages, have they?
Your Honor, that is the crux of the question before you, whether there is injury, number one, right? So the statute 146.84 that you're referring to says that a violator, which is somebody who gives up something in the patient health care record, shall be liable, mandatory, to a person injured. What is the injury? The injury in this instance is the loss of a privacy right. Does that rise to an injury, and does it rise to a damage or harm, as you mentioned, Judge?
So is it your position that the mere violation equates an injury?
It is hardly a mere violation, but yes,
well,
Your Honor.
That a violation equals an injury.
That a violation.
How do you read the statute?
A violation of the patient health care record does not equal an injury, right? The patient health care record, if you read 146.82, is everything that the doctor and the hospital have, right? It's that whole record. In that record are things like your last name, your middle name, things like your account number. So if there is disclosure of something in that record that doesn't get us to privacy, right, because you look to 995.50, what is privacy? That's the publication, the unreasonable publication of private affairs, right? So you can have a violation of the patient health care record, and you may not have an injury. But here we do have an injury, because what was in that health care record that is that does create the injury is what our clients actually suffered from. So it was of no interest to the public that it is now disclosed that a client of mine may have a sexually transmitted disease or needed psychological care. That is not the interest of the public. That is not the interest of the bankruptcy court. So the violation, to get back to your question, the violation goes to the patient health care record, but the injury is the loss of your privacy on your personal medical information.
So then let's say you had a sexually transmitted disease. How has that information been used to injure a particular plaintiff?
How is the disclosure?
You know, I don't know, somebody needs a job and they applied for a job and it's a job where they can't have sexually transmitted diseases or something like that.
Well, there'd be many people.
And they got denied the job. I mean, do you have a plaintiff like that where that particular information was utilized and it injured that plaintiff in some way? Other than the fact that it was just disclosed.
We don't know. And think about, we don't know. So I don't have a client who says, I know for certain, my boss came up to me and said, you're fired. And by the way, you're fired because you have gonorrhea. No, I don't have that. But when we hear that, when the people of Wisconsin hear, you're going to disclose out my patient client, I mean my patient and doctor discussions because you're owed a bill. You know, that sends people in Wisconsin to the point where, hey, this is unreasonable. In fact, Judge Kelly, when she was reviewing it, she looked at the proof of claim form and she said, there's some really hairy things in here. There's some really hairy things in here. You don't need to disclose to everyone that whatever your medical maladies are, that doesn't need to be put out in the public. Once it's public, the bell's rung, right? PACER has mirror sites. People go into PACER, they take the information, they re-chop it. You can find out what people have. You can go into PACER and find out which politician's son has what, and now you're going to be able to find out in Wisconsin what their medical condition is. Well, that's unreasonable.
I'd like to talk about the statutory wording for a second, okay? We've got a statute which, let's say it's ambiguous. I mean, you're not saying it clearly provides for nominal damages as a basis for exemplary damages, right? There's some question about it.
No, I don't.
How do you think we ought to go about construing the statute?
Right. I believe that the statute is unambiguous.
Unambiguous.
That's right. And you cannot, in Wisconsin, use extrinsic evidence to make a statute ambiguous. That's the Kalal case in Wisconsin. So you look at this statute. The statute as it sits tells us the intent of the drafters. The drafters put in some special mechanisms within this statute that you don't see in others. First of all, in Wisconsin, you never see, there are no statutes which say nominal damages. So if you did Alexa search for nominal damages and you put in the code, you'll never find that the Wisconsin legislature ever said nominal damages. But nominal damages are awarded in Wisconsin, right? Nominal damages are immeasurable in mere dollars, but they are actual harm. How do we know that? Jackie versus Steinberg says to us that when the right is really important, right, like the property right in Jackie versus Steinberg, the right to control your property, then nominal, if somebody then invades your property, trespasses, nominal damages will be the actual damage. Why? Because you lost this important right. Well, in Wisconsin, if you look at 995.50, the important right is privacy. It's codified, not common law.
Jackie is the only case like that, right? There's only one case in all of Wisconsin law that comes to that conclusion.
I think there is another case, Mongois or something like that. I think it was cited.
I guess my question for you is, I mean, if we thought this was a Jackie-like case, wouldn't we have to certify it? Is that a decision that this court can make?
Well, I think the question is best certified because there is uniqueness in the Wisconsin law here. I think it's best certified to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to decide it because, those of us who came from other – I came from another state to Wisconsin – privacy, is this common law. And in common law, we know that when we have just the straight-out tort, usually we need something beyond nominal damages to get to the rest of the statute.
But I'm kind of whipsawed with the concept of the statute being clear. I mean, you're saying on the one hand that the statute is unambiguous.
Yes.
And if it's unambiguous, why certify it? I mean, if anybody reading the statute would know what it means.
Well, Your Honor, I would never argue with you about whether to certify the case or not.
Don't we have to find that there's some ambiguity in the statute before we can do that?
before you can certify?
Certify it, yeah.
I don't believe you have to do that. I believe this is a very unique set of cases and a very unique set of rights. And you don't have something that's right on point, right? We talk about Jackie versus Steinberg. It's easy to say, well, that's just a trespass case. But that's more, if you look at the reasoning behind it. So I'm trying to use this reasoning that the Supreme Court holds as proper reasoning on when you lose a legal right and say, well, privacy is a really important legal right to the people of Wisconsin, and maybe that is a proper time for the Wisconsin Supreme Court to make that decision.
Didn't the drafters actually have a nominal damage provision in the statute originally? Didn't it originally say that to bring an action you didn't have to suffer or be threatened with actual damages?
Your Honor, that does not. Stricken. Yeah, there was a provision. You are absolutely correct. There was a provision that you did not have to suffer actual damages. So you don't have to prove actual damages. It's essentially that provision that the governor took out. But that's an overreading of what the governor did. If we're now going to argue the intent of the governor, one can argue that the intent of the governor was to really give power to the first line Judge Williams mentioned, which is, hey, the violator is liable to a person injured, right? So what the governor is basically...
Well, one way to look at it is that the statute without that provision doesn't support a nominal damage case, and with that provision gone, then that's gone.
Oh, I would disagree wholeheartedly.
Where else do you find the nominal damage authority within the statute?
The nominal damage authority is the actual damage, right? So what is the actual damage one loses when their medical information, the medical malady, is published, when 3,200 people have this, you know, what happened to you with your doctor is now published? There is a great harm to society, which is, you know, now I'm taking it back to Jackie. The great harm to society is we need to protect property rights. The great harm to society is what you tell your doctor is no longer privileged. If you run out of insurance, they can just, what, publish on the side of a bus that what diseases you have? Well, they can't publish it. They can't make it public. So when it becomes public, what your harm is your loss of medical privacy. That is your harm. That is also your injury in this case. What the governor took out when he took out that last line was to say, if you have something in a patient health care record, right, I could say, well, I don't like that people know my middle name. They took it from the health care record. I don't have to prove any damage. I don't have to show any actual damages. I can maintain that sort of a strike suit. That's what the governor's scared of. What Aurora's arguing is that, no, the governor's scared of all suits, other than the one that Judge Williams suggested, which is you have to find this one employer in the world who says, I'm firing you because you have AIDS. Well, that's just like the movie Philadelphia, right? You have to find that the employer is foolish enough to tell you why he's firing you.
Well,
the fact is, you
reasons.
Don't know because it's public.
There are lots of reasons information could be used, not just in the employment situation, but your bottom line is we should just ignore the governor's line item veto, that it means it essentially meant nothing.
No, I believe it meant something. There is a difference between the medical information in the patient health care record and the patient health care record. The patient health care record is everything in the file, including my last name and my account number. The medical information in the patient health care file is, does the person have this sexually transmitted disease? That, when you disclose to the public the sexually transmitted disease, that's where you've really harmed the person, but you've also harmed the public. Because now people in Wisconsin have to be careful when they go to their doctor. Don't tell your doctor you have hepatitis. My God, I'll put it in the record. And then Aurora will publish it. Who wants that? That is why Wisconsin put a very strong statute into place here. Wisconsin put a number of statutes, starting with 995.50, and then strengthened it with 146.82 and then 84, and then gave a significant limitation on the times when you can reveal. They list them in 146.82. They list 22 times when you can reveal, none of which are mentioned are here in this case. So they do not have carte blanche to tell the world the medical condition. At the end of the day, Aurora is not arguing that they didn't put out the medical condition. Aurora is not arguing that they didn't publish to the world the conversation between my client and the putative class of 3,200 people and their doctor.
And I think we understand that argument. You're into your rebuttal time if you want to save any time.
I'll save the remainder, and I apologize. I didn't recognize that.
Mr. McGrath.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Brian McGrath. I represent the appellee Aurora Healthcare. As the court is well aware from the argument that just occurred, this is a case under 146.84 of the Wisconsin statutes. Below, these plaintiffs alleged in their complaints that they had actual damages, and they argued to the bankruptcy court that they had actual damages. They've now shifted the argument to this court to say, even though below we asserted we have them, their argument to this court is we don't need them. We can receive exemplary or punitive damages under 146.84 in the absence of actual damages. And there are three reasons why that argument is incorrect, and I think the court has already hit on all three in its questions, but let me just go through them. The first is the actual language of 146.84, under which a person can be liable only if there is both an injury and a violation. It is, in fact, the appellant's position that a violation alone, a disclosure of patient health care information by itself, is sufficient to state a claim under 146.84, but that's contradicted by the language of the statute, which requires an injury and a violation, so those must be two different things. And what the injury has to be is disclosed later in the statute. It has to be actual damages. The second point, it has been the law of the state of Wisconsin for 100 years that to receive exemplary or punitive damages, a plaintiff must have actual damages.
That's the common law, though, right? And this statute is clearly in derogation of the common law. I mean, there's a Wisconsin statute that says the normal mental states for exemplary damages don't apply to the statute. Isn't that correct?
It is, in fact, the common law, Your Honor. Now, the law of Wisconsin also says that to derogate the common law, you must do that expressly, and it's not clear that 146.84 was intended, at least in the form it was passed, to expressly derogate the common law. In fact, that would bring the third issue before the court, which is the governor's veto. I mean, under Wisconsin law, the governor's veto becomes part of the legislative history of this statute, and as finally passed after the gubernatorial veto, the statute is precisely consistent with the common law, which is that you must have actual damages in order to receive any award of punitive or exemplary damages.
But it does say you get actual damages, exemplary damages, and actual attorney's fees. So in three separate categories.
It does, Your Honor, but to get any of them, there must be an injury under Section 146.84. So that's where the language of the statute requires two things, an injury and liability, in order to get to the next category. And, you know, we have both cited the Doe versus Chow case, if I'm pronouncing that right, from the U.S. Supreme Court, interpreting the U.S. Privacy Act. And that statute that the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted in Doe is actually more favorable to a plaintiff than 146.84. It didn't require for liability to be an injury and a violation. It just required a violation. And then just like our statute, it says that you can receive actual damages, but no person shall receive less than $1,000. So the Supreme Court read the reference to actual damages to be an actual hurdle that you must follow in order to get any damage, or a hurdle you must jump to get any damages, even without the injury language that 146.84 has. And even though that statute said, but every plaintiff should get at least $1,000, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you first have to show actual damages to even get to that point. So in interpreting this statute, The court can look to the U.S. Supreme Court statutory interpretation in the Doe case, and I think you get precisely the result that we asked for.
It was different language, though, wasn't it? I mean, the Supreme Court was construing different language.
Different language, but more favorable to the plaintiff's position in this case than the language in our statute. So to me, it's sort of a fortiori. If under that language actual damage is required, then certainly it would be required under this statute. And we also get back to the point that the court has already made, which is the result the plaintiffs want was in this statute as it came through the legislature, that it was not a prerequisite to make a claim that you suffer or will suffer actual damages, and that was vetoed. And so what the plaintiffs are really saying to this court is, please overturn the gubernatorial veto. Please put that language back into this statute, because it is the only way that we can prevail. But, of course, it's not really the job of the court, of any court, to overturn the express will of the legislature and the governor acting together in the legislative capacity.
Before the bankruptcy judge ever got to the legislative history, she had to, or at least should have found, that the statute was ambiguous, correct?
That's not actually correct under Wisconsin law. Under the Kalal case, which we cite in our brief, and so do they, the court says, and it's perhaps unique to Wisconsin, but that a court can look to the legislative history to confirm the meaning of an unambiguous statute. That's what Kalal says, and that's essentially what Judge Kelly did, because Judge Kelly, in her words, describes really the legislative history here as unimpeachable in terms of reaching the result that that actual damages are required under this statute. There were three other separate and independent grounds that justify summary judgment on behalf of Aurora that we've addressed in our brief. I want to make three points with respect to those additional bases upon which this court could affirm the judgment. The first is the billing, collection, and payment exception to Section 146.82. Opposing counsel's right. There's 22 exceptions, circumstances under which a healthcare provider can, in some cases shall, disclose patient health care information without informed consent. And 146.82 is the billing, collection, and payment exception.
Of course, if these documents had been provided under seal to the bankruptcy court, we wouldn't be here.
We wouldn't, but there's no requirement in Section 146.82, the billing, collection, and payment exception, that the documents be provided to anybody under seal. The statute says that you can
I understand it's not a requirement. I'm just saying, given the sensitive nature of some of this information that's being provided, it certainly is a way to approach it with caution. So the court still gets what it needs in order to make those determinations, which you argue it needs that specific data, and you still protect the rights of the patient.
I understand that your position, Your Honor. We also point out in our briefs that that is the way it happens today, and it happens that way today because of a change in the bankruptcy rules.
Right. Well, I understand there's a change, but the point. Go ahead.
The rule didn't require disclosure of the information. The form itself gave you the option of redacting the information submitted or submitting a summary. I have trouble with your argument that the rule and the forms required the submission of that personal information.
The rule required you to submit any document upon which your claim is based, and then suggested as particular documents, invoices or statements of account.
And these weren't invoices that were sent to the patients. These were invoices created for the purpose of submitting as part of proof of claim.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. This is the statement of running account maintained by Aurora in the normal course of its business.
They're printed the same date or roughly the same date as the submission of the proof of claim.
Right.
Didn't go to the patients.
Your Honor, in this day and age, nobody keeps paper records, right. So we keep an electronic record of the statement of running account, so it'll print out on the date, on whatever, or print out the date on which you print it out.
But is there a Wisconsin case that interprets the use of this type of document attached to your claim form in a billing context as not violating that privacy law?
There are no cases with respect to that section of the statute.
Wouldn't we have to expand the judgment, the nature of the judgment, substantially to reach that result for you as another basis of affirming?
I don't believe you have to expand the judgment, Your Honor. It would be a separate basis to affirm the judgment. In other words, that Aurora was entitled to summary judgment because its conduct in the first instance wasn't a violation of 146.82, and therefore you never get to 146.84. The point with respect to the billing, collection and payment exception is that it applies in all contexts for billing, collection, and payment. And I would say to the court, there's really five things that a healthcare provider ought to be able to say in billing, collection, and payment purposes. One, I'm a healthcare provider. Two, this person was my patient. Three, these are the services I provided. Four, this is what I charged. And five, this amount is unpaid. And you have to say those five things when you submit records, patient healthcare records, to a third-party payor, to an insurance company. You have to say those five things when you submit them to the government for government assistance-type payments, Medicare or Medicaid. And you have to say them to the court when you go that route for billing, collection, and payment purposes. But those same five things, there's only one exception, and they apply in all contexts. So those same five things ought to be appropriate in all contexts, especially when we're dealing with the rules that were then in existence. And I know, Your Honor, for example, you've said that the rule in 2007, 2008 said you can attach redacted documents. And it did, but you have to look at what the rule then defined as redaction. And what it said you should redact are things like Social Security numbers. All right, it did not say that you should redact the substantive information that was contained in the bill, that's contained in your bill. That didn't happen until 2008, and that's when Aurora changed its practice. So when the court itself defined redaction in the proof of claim form and instructions to be limited to certain items, it was reasonable for Aurora to apply the rule in that fashion and only to redact those things that it was told to redact by the bankruptcy court. The other point I wanted to make before I close is the second exception that the second additional ground that we talked about to justify summary judgment here is the absolute litigation privilege. And I think, in addition, that impacts the correct reading of 146.82.
Is that controlled by Wisconsin law here or federal law?
At the end of the day, we believe it's controlled by Wisconsin law. We've provided the court with both federal and state law on this, and they appear to be precisely the same. But at the end of the day, we believe that the absolute litigation privilege in this case would be controlled by Wisconsin law, but we don't see any differences. And the key case with respect to this is the Snow versus Keppel case, which we cite. It's a 1990 case, so it's when 146.82 had been on the books for about 8 years, the medical Wisconsin medical privacy statute. 146.82 is not cited in the case, but in that case in 1990, the Wisconsin court said that the absolute litigation privilege is a good defense to a claim of medical records privacy. And so it applied the absolute litigation privilege, the common law doctrine, 8 years after the passage of 146.82, and therefore that common law defense of absolute litigation privilege was alive and in place 8 years after 146.82. It also ought to help this court in interpreting 146.82 in a narrower way to say that in this particular instance, when Aurora simply said the five things that every provider has to say in billing and collection purposes and said them in the context of the bankruptcy rules as they existed at that time, that fits within the absolute litigation privilege, that this was a pleading submitted to the bankruptcy court, and proofs of claim are entitled to the absolute litigation privilege. We've cited cases on that. And by saying those five typical things, I'm a provider, this is a patient, here's the services, here's the charges, here's what I'm still owed, that information easily fits within the context of 146.82 and is protected by the state and or the federal absolute litigation privilege, whichever this court should apply. And as I said, we believe that they're precisely the same here. With that, unless the court has further questions, I've completed my argument.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. And Mr. Watton, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Gottschalk, there is the case I was trying to mention before where with the Wisconsin Supreme Court held in 2010 that nominal damages are always appropriate, even if proved compensatory damages may also be awarded, is called GRYGIEL, or spelled Griegel versus Monches, M-O-N-C-H-E-S, at 2010 Wisconsin 93, paragraph 44, 787 Northwest 2nd, 6. It's a 2010 case. Secondly, I think we're all having trouble with where does nominal damage fit. So if we had a coin of damages on both sides, one side would be actual, the other side would be equitable. Where do nominal fit? In Wisconsin, they are immeasurable, but certain and actual. They just don't have a dollar figure. They're immeasurable in mere dollars. The areas that my opponent mentions to you, these other areas, I see I'm out of time.
Yeah, I'll give you one more minute.
Okay, thank you. The areas that they mention are not before the court. There is a very specific question before the court today. There was no appeal of Judge Kelly's other orders on which those decisions were made. Additionally, in Snow versus Keppel that was mentioned, the balance, there is a secondary balance in both the Fed and state court when you federal and state law when you're looking at the litigation privilege, and there's a balance of rights, and there was no balance made in Snow versus Keppel, which talked about the privacy rights. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Thank you, counsel, for your fine briefs and your very fine oral argument. We'll take the case under advisement.